Appreciate the opportunity to be with you here tonight, and especially to be here when the college students are have the service. I feel right at home. I tell you, most of them are BJ students, and I feel almost like a proud daddy up here listening to them sing and take part of the service. And unfortunately, these are not the young people that I get so well acquainted with. And I tell them, if I don't know your name, that's probably a good sign. But I tell you what, it is a blessing to work with college students and to work with them and on the front end of their lives. And I think this is what God created me to do, is work with college students like this. I just love every minute of it. And some parts I like better than others, but when it comes to the discipline. But Patty and I were supposed to be at the Wilds a couple of weekends ago, and the hurricane came through and canceled all of that. And there was a message I had burning in my soul that I couldn't deliver during that time, and some other circumstances are going to keep me away from the men's retreat. And a lot of what I had to say up at the Wilds had to do with some things I was hoping to help our men with. And when Pastor Crawford asked me if I would speak here tonight, I thought yes. So this will give me an opportunity to unload what God has been burdening me about, and I'm calling this the essential ingredient for a stable home. I want to begin reading something to you. I don't think I've read this here before. If I have, just pretend that you haven't heard it. But it says this: most people in their early 20s or before begin searching for the perfect human being with whom to spend the rest of their lives. And when they find someone who seems to fit that general description, they tumble head over heels into sheer ecstasy. There is no feeling in the world quite like it. They can hardly take their eyes off each other, and they want to be together every moment of the day. They spend their hours picnicking in parks and walking in the rain and sitting glassy-eyed by a crackling fire. They even invade one another's dreams at night. This exhilaration of romantic love is so captivating that it leads naturally to the question of marriage. A starry-eyed couple seems to reason, if this feeling is so neat, why don't we spend our entire lives together? So they begin making plans for the wedding. They set the date and call the preacher and order the flowers. Finally, the big night arrives with the bride nervous and the groom bewildered. The bride's mother cries through the ceremony and her father is pale and tense. The bratty little flower girl refuses to walk down the aisle. And the groom's sister butchers a sentimental song about eternal love. But somehow the couple says, "I do," and the preacher pronounces them man and wife, and they march down the aisle, each flashing 32 teeth as they head for the reception room. There is noise and laughter and kisses for the bride as the people file by to offer best wishes to the new Mr. and Mrs. And they eat the nuts and choke down the cake and talk about their own weddings. At last, the bride and groom run from the church in a shower of rice and confetti and drive off to start a new life together. And as they leave, they hear the groom's sister crooning, "They've only just begun." So far, so good. Everybody is happy and excited. But for this grinning couple, serious trouble lies ahead. Almost from the first day of the honeymoon, something changes in their relationship. That tremendous excitement and enthusiasm begins to fade a bit. Marriage itself takes on a new look. Instead of being something they hoped they could capture if they were lucky, it now becomes a lifetime entanglement that has sprung a trap in reverse. They wonder silently whether this is what they really wanted or whether they have made the biggest mistake of their lives. The third day of the honeymoon brings the first real fight. The couple disagreed on where they should eat dinner and how much money they should spend. She wanted to eat at a romantic restaurant, and he thought they should have a hamburger with Ronald McDonald. It was a minor argument, but some harsh words were exchanged that further damaged the romantic feeling with which they began. They would learn to hurt each other more effectively in the months ahead. They'd only been home from the honeymoon about a week when the first all-out battle occurred. Insults were hurled back and forth like nuclear warheads. Deep feelings of hurt and resentment then raged on both sides, followed by long periods of icy silence. The husband left home for 2 hours and his wife called her mother. From them to the bitter end, we see two extremely bitter and unhappy people who cry themselves to sleep at night. And what is worse, they may have produced another member of the family by that time, a toothless little guy who has to have his diapers changed every 45 minutes. This toddler will grow up in a broken home and will never fully understand why Daddy doesn't live here anymore. And we have to ask ourselves, what happened and where did they go wrong? Because too many marriages start out expecting something entirely different. Too many relationships between employee and employer start out very like a honeymoon experience, and everything is going well and it deteriorates after that. And the missing ingredient is something we want to look at tonight. Let's bow in prayer. Lord Jesus, I pray that you would open our eyes to the kind of people you want us to be. This morning you showed us in your word here from Ezekiel the kind of God you are. And I pray that we might be humbled before you, our great God, and we might learn what you have for us tonight. Teach us, we pray, in your name. Amen. The missing ingredient is commitment to God and others. And I want us to talk about commitment tonight and what it means and what destroys it and how to build it. The meaning of commitment is found in John 13, 34 to 35, where our Lord Himself says, "A new commandment I give unto you, that you love one another as I have loved you. By this shall all men know that you are my disciples, if you have love one to another." And what we call commitment today is what God calls love. In fact, we could define love as love is choosing the welfare of another at your own expense. This is what Jesus Christ did for us at Calvary. He chose our welfare at His expense. Anybody who has ever loved in a biblical fashion has chosen the good and the welfare of other people at his own expense. That is so much different from lust, because lust uses other people's for your own design. Love isn't like that at all. Love sacrifices yourself for the welfare of somebody else. Love is a choice. In fact, when God says to us in Luke and several other passages in Scripture where He repeats the great commandment, where He says, "Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, with all thy mind. This is the first and great commandment, and the second is like unto it. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself." Don't be distracted by that word love and saying, I don't have these warm and fuzzy feelings toward God. That will come in your devotion to God. But when He says, "Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart," that is a command. You cannot command an emotion. You can command choices, but you can't command emotions. You can't turn to somebody and say, "Be loving." You can tell somebody to do a loving thing, but you can't command an emotion. And what God is talking about here is not necessarily an emotion. In fact, when He says, "Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart," He's talking about the same thing when He says in the first commandment that thou shalt have no other gods before me. Thou shalt choose me first. And love, commitment, is choosing somebody else first above ourselves. And you can always tell who somebody is committed to by whose welfare they seek with their choices. It's not uncommon for a lot of marriages to begin like this one that we read about just a few minutes ago. We call that a tick on a dog relationship. And they get married and find out there are two ticks and no dog. Both of them are parasites looking for a host. They're looking for somebody else to make them feel good. They're not looking for to give themselves for somebody else's welfare. They're looking for somebody to be there for them. And that component is in all of our marriages as we begin. I think most of us begin with some lofty thoughts of why we are in this thing, but down deep when we begin, we're basically in this for ourselves. And unless we grow out of that, the marriage will end like this one as well. And what we thought was, what we wanted to be mutual ministry ends up being mutual manipulation. How can we get the other person to do for us what we want him to do for us without causing too much trouble for ourselves? That's the meaning of commitment. When we talk about commitment, it is basically biblical agape love, choosing the welfare of another at your own expense. Let's talk about the measure of commitment. How can you measure whether you have much commitment or biblical love or not? Well, 1 John 5:3 says, "For this is the love of God, that we keep His commandments, and His commandments are not grievous, they're not burdensome." And if you're really committed to somebody, they're not a burden to you. Gentlemen, if you're committed to your wife, she is no burden to you, no matter how sick she gets, no matter how discouraged she gets, no matter how ill-tempered you might think she gets, she's not a burden to you if you love her. We have here a wonderful, wonderful ministry of Faith Baptist Church and Hidden Treasure Christian Schools. A lot of young people who need a lot of help. And if you would ask any of those parents and say, is your son or your daughter who has these special needs, are they a burden to you? And they would say, oh, well, we have to do a lot of extra things and it requires a lot of extra time and attention, but oh no, they're not a burden. We love them. If somebody becomes a burden to you, it's because your love has gone south. That's true for working with a handicapped child. It's true for we as students when we are members of Bob Jones or any other school. The size of whether or not that is burdensome to us, all of the demands academically, all of the demands with the policies and so forth, whether that's a burden or not has everything to do with the size of our commitment. In fact, we could say it this way, that the burden of any responsibility is not determined by the size of that responsibility, but by the size of your commitment. Is it a heavier responsibility to take care of a special needs child? Yes. But if that's a burden to you, that has nothing to do with the size of the responsibility. It has everything to do with the size of your commitment, the size of your love. And students, the size of the burden of going to Bob Jones University has nothing to do with the size of the assignments or the size of the handbook. Whether that's a burden to you or not has everything to do with the size of your commitment to Jesus Christ and His calling for you. The same thing is true for an employer and his expectations for us. The size of the burden of that employer to us is not determined by the size of the responsibilities and the demands he makes, but the size of our commitment to what God has called us to do. I want to read you something that my wife found in some of her research for a talk she was doing. It appeared in Christianity Today, and it is about Robertson McQuilkin, who was the president of Columbia Bible College and Seminary. And this article says, as his wife suffered with Alzheimer's, Robertson McQuilkin said, if I took care of her for 40 years, I would never be out of her debt. After his wife was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, college and seminary president Robertson McQuilkin found himself torn between two commitments, two divine callings. And here is his testimony. He says, it has been a decade, 10 years, since that day in Florida when Muriel, my wife, repeated to the couple vacationing with us the story she had just told 5 minutes earlier. Funny, I thought. That's never happened before. But it began to happen occasionally. 3 years later, when Muriel was hospitalized for tests on her heart, a young doctor called me aside. He said, you may need to think about the possibility of Alzheimer's. I was incredulous. These young doctors are so presumptuous and insensitive. Muriel was doing the same thing she had always done, for the most part. True, we had stopped entertaining in our home. No small loss for the president of a thriving seminary and Bible college. She was a great cook and hostess, but she was having increasing difficulty planning menus. Family meals she could handle, but with guests we could not risk missing a salad and dessert, for example. And yes, she was having uncommon difficulty painting a portrait of me, which the college and seminary board, impressed by her earlier splendid portrait of my predecessor, had requested. But Alzheimer's? While I had barely heard of the disease, a dread began to lurk around the fringes of my consciousness. When her memory deteriorated further, we went to Joe Tabor, a neurologist friend, who gave her the full battery of tests and by elimination confirmed that she had Alzheimer's. But because she had none of the typical physical deterioration, there were some questions. We went to Duke University Medical Center, believing we should get the best available second opinion. My heart sank as the doctor asked her to name the Gospels, and she looked pleadingly at me for help. But she quickly bounced back and laughed at herself. She was a little nervous, perhaps, but nothing was going to get her down. This time we accepted the verdict. And we determined from the outset not to chase around the country every new miracle treatment we might hear about. Little did I know the day was coming when we would be urged, on average once a week, to pursue every variety of treatments, vitamins, exorcism, chemicals, this guru, that healer. How could I even look into them all, let alone pursue them? I was grateful to friends who made suggestions, but because each was an expression of love. But for us, we would trust the Lord to work a miracle in Muriel if He so desired, or work a miracle in me if He didn't. One day, the WMHK station manager, the program manager, and the producer of my wife's morning radio program entitled Looking Up asked for an appointment. I knew an occasional program she had produced was not used, but the response to her monologue of upbeat encouragement continued to be strong. Though the program was designed for women, businessmen often told me how they arranged their morning affairs so they could catch the program. As the appointment began, the three executives seemed uneasy. After a few false starts, I caught on. They were reluctantly letting me know that an era was ending. Only months before, they had talked of national syndication. I tried to help them out. "Are you meeting with me to tell us that Mural cannot continue?" They seemed relieved that their painful message was out and none of them had to say it. So I thought, her public ministry is over. No more conferences, TV, radio. I should have guessed the time had come. She did not think so, however. She may have lost the radio program, but she insisted on accepting invitations to speak, even though invariably she would come home crushed and bewildered that her train of thought was lost and things did not go well. Gradually, reluctantly, she gave up her public ministry. Still, she could counsel the many young people who sought her out. She could drive and shop or write her children. The letters did not always make sense, but then the children would say, "Mom always was a bit spacey." She also volunteered to read textbooks for a blind graduate student. The plan was to put them on tape so that others could use them. I was puzzled that those responsible never used them until it dawned on me that reading and writing were going the way of art and public speaking. She was disappointed with each failure and frustration, but only momentarily she would bounce back with laughter and have another go at it. Mural never knew what was happening to her, though occasionally when there was a reference to Alzheimer's on TV, she would muse aloud, "I wonder if I'll ever have that." It did not seem painful for her, but it was a slow dying for me to watch the vibrant, creative, articulate person I knew and loved gradually dimming out. I approached the College Board of Trustees with the need to begin the search for my successor. I told them that when the day came that Mural needed me full time, she would have me. I hoped that would not be necessary till I reached retirement, but at 57, it seemed unlikely I could hold on until 65. They should begin to make plans, but they intended for me to stay on forever, I guess, and made no move. That's not realistic and probably not very responsible, I thought, though I appreciated the affirmation. So began years of struggle with the question of what should be sacrificed, ministry or caring for Mural. Should I put the kingdom of God first, hate my wife, and for the sake of Christ in the kingdom, arrange for institutionalization? Trusted longtime friends, wise and godly, urged me to do this. They said, Mural would become accustomed to the new environment quickly. Would she? Would anyone love her at all, let alone love her as I do? I had often seen the empty, listless faces of those lined up in wheelchairs along the corridors of such places, waiting for the fleeting visit of some loved one. In such an environment, Mural would be tamed only with drugs or bodily restraints, of that I was confident. People who do not know me well have said, "Well, you've always said God first, family second, ministry third," but I never said that. To put God first means that all other responsibilities He gives are first too. Sorting out responsibilities that seem to conflict, however, is tricky business. In 1988, we planned for our first family reunion since the six children had left home, a week in a mountain retreat. Mural delighted in her children and grandchildren, and they in her. Banqueting with all those gourmet cooks, making a quilt that pictured our life scene by scene, playing games, singing, picking wild mountain blueberries, marvelous. We planned it as the celebration of our 40th anniversary, although actually it was the 39th. We feared that by the 40th she would no longer be with us. She would no longer know us. But she still knows us 3 years later. She cannot comprehend much nor express many thoughts, and those not for sure. But she knows whom she loves and lives in a happy oblivion to almost everything else. She is such a delight to me. I don't have to care for her. I get to. One blessing is the way she is teaching me so much about love, for example, God's love. She picks flowers outside, anyone's, and fills the house with them. Lately, she has begun to pick them inside, too. Someone had given us a beautiful Easter lily, two stems with four or five lilies on each and more to come. One day, I came into the kitchen and there on the windowsill over the sink was a vase with a stem of lilies in it. I've learned to go with the flow and not correct irrational behavior. She means no harm and does not understand what should be done, nor would she remember a rebuke. Nevertheless, I did the irrational. I told her how disappointed I was, how the lilies would soon die, the buds would never bloom, and please do not break off the other stem. The next day, our youngest son, soon to leave for India, came from Houston for his next to last visit. I told Kent of my rebuke of his mother and how bad I felt about it. As we sat on the porch swing, savoring each moment together, his mother came to the door with a gift of love for me. She carefully laid the other stem of lilies on the table with a gentle smile and turned back into the house. I simply said, "Thank you." Kent said, "You're doing better, Dad." Muriel cannot speak in sentences now, only in phrases and words, and often words that make little sense. No, when she means yes, for example, but she can say one sentence, and she says it often, "I love you." She not only says it, she acts it. The board arranged for a companion to stay in our home so I could go daily to the office. During those 2 years, it became increasingly difficult to keep Muriel home. As soon as I left, she would take out after me. With me, she was content. Without me, she was distressed, sometimes terror-stricken. The walk to school is a mile round trip. She would make that trip as many as 10 times a day looking for me. Sometimes at night when I helped her undress, I found bloody feet. When I told the family doctor, he choked up. "Such love," he said simply. Then after a moment, he said, "I have a theory that the characteristics developed across the years come out at times like these. I wish I loved God like that, desperate to be near Him at all times. Thus she teaches me day by day." Friends and family often ask, "How are you doing?" Meaning, I would take it, "How do you feel?" I am at a loss to respond. There is that subterranean grief that will not go away. I feel just as alone as if I'd never known her as she was, I suppose. But the loneliness of the night hours comes because I did know her. Do I grieve for her loss or mine? Further, there is a sorrow that comes from my increasing difficulty in meeting her needs. But I guess my friends are asking not about her needs, but about mine. Or perhaps they wonder, in the contemporary jargon, how am I coping, as they reflect on how the reputed indispensable characteristics of a good marriage have slipped away one by one. He says, as she needed me more and more, I wrestled daily with the question of who gets me full time, Muriel or Columbia Bible College and Seminary. Dr. Tabor, the neurologist, advised me not to make any decision based on my desire to see Muriel stay contented. Make your plans apart from that question. Whether or not you can be successful in your dreams for the college and seminary or not, I cannot judge, but I can tell you now, you will not be successful with Muriel. When the time came, the decision was firm. It took no great calculation. It was a matter of integrity. Had I not promised 42 years before, in sickness and in health, till death do us part? This was no grim duty to which I stoically resigned, however. It was only fair. She had, after all, cared for me almost 4 decades with marvelous devotion. Now it was my turn, and such a partner she was. If I took care of her for 40 years, I would never outpay the debt. But how could I walk away from the responsibility of a ministry? God had blessed so signally during our 22 years at Columbia Bible College and Seminary. Not easily. True, many dreams had been fulfilled, but so many dreams were yet on the drawing board. And the peerless team, God had brought together a team not just of professionals, but of dear friends. How could I bear to leave them? Resignation was painful, but the right path was not difficult to discern. Whatever Columbia needed, it did not need a part-time distracted leader. It was better to move out and let God designate a leader to step in while the momentum was continuing. No, it was not a choice between two loves. Sometimes that kind of choice becomes necessary, but this time responsibilities did not conflict. I suppose in the will of God, they never conflict, though my evaluation of those responsibilities is fallible. Am I making the right choice at the right time in the right way? I hope so. This time it seemed clear in the best interest of the ministry for me to step down, even if board and administrators thought otherwise. Both loves for Muriel and for the Bible College dictated the same choice. There was no conflict of loves then, or of obligations. I have been startled by the response to the announcement of my resignation. Husbands and wives renew marriage vows. Pastors tell the story to their congregations. It was a mystery to me until a distinguished oncologist who lives constantly with dying people told me almost all women stand by their men. Very few men stand by their women. Perhaps people sensed this contemporary tragedy and somehow were helped by a simple choice I considered the only option. Folks, that's the measure of commitment. This is not, and read this statement again in front of you. The burden of any responsibility is not determined by the size of that responsibility. but by the size of your commitment. Was there more responsibility for this man to take as he took care of his wife? Yes. But that doesn't mean it's more of a burden. Only if your commitment is low. I want us to talk next about the menace to commitment. What destroys it? Hebrews 13:5 says, "Let your conversation or your lifestyle be without covetousness." This desire for something more and something else. "And be content with such things as ye have, for he has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you." When a man or a woman begins to be ruled by his self or her self-centered desires, the commitment is destroyed. In marriages, the most tragic are destroyed by another menace to commitment, an affair. And tragically, in our country, there are almost more marriages with an affair than those without. And unfortunately, the rate is growing in among God's people as well. And just as lethal are the affairs that might be going on in marriages here. And I'm not necessarily talking about a sexual affair, because see, an affair is any over-involvement that drains energy from the primary commitment. And while affair can be sexual, it doesn't have to be. A man can be overly involved with his work. A woman can be overly involved with her children or her job. A person can be overly involved with his sports. A person can be overly involved with his hobbies. And so you're just being kind of melodramatic there. No, I'm not, because here's what Jesus said in James 4:4. He said, "Ye adulterers and adulteresses, those of you having affairs with the world, know ye not that friendship with the world is enmity with God?" God considers when we are overly involved with something else that drains energy away from the primary commitment, God Himself called that adultery. And we must be very, very careful. We have made commitments. We've made commitments in our marriages. We have made commitments to our employers. We have made commitments to our families. We have made commitments to our schools. And we can have affairs that drain the energy away from those primary commitments. Things that please us. And sacrifice other people instead of sacrificing ourselves for the benefit of other people. We're sacrificing them for the benefit of ourselves. I want us to talk. I want us to see the four R's of an affair. It is the same for a marriage. Any kind of an affair in a marriage. And again, I'm not just talking about a sexual affair, but about any kind of over-involvement, where we start paying more attention to something out there or something right in front of us instead of what our responsibilities are in our family and our marriage. Or with a student who has a primary responsibility to do what God has called him to do, and he can be distracted and called out to all kinds of other things. And the true for our employment as well. The first one is resentment. Relationships start with expectations, that, like that couple that we read about at the very beginning. They had all kinds of wonderful expectations, but pretty soon they realized that the other person wasn't really on board for doing things the way he or she wanted them done. And their unfulfilled expectations. And a person begins focusing on what the other person or the other party is not doing for them any longer. And they say, "This isn't what I thought it was when we first signed up for this whole thing. She didn't tell me I'd have to whatever. I didn't know about that when I applied for this job or this school." And we begin to get bitter and begin to resent the extra demands, and we have unfulfilled expectations. You know, if you're trying to buy something on eBay and you're bidding for that thing, and you have an expectation, I'm going to, you know, maybe it's worth brand new $40, and right now the bid is at $6. And so you put in as a cap on $10. And then pretty soon you find out that your cap is beat by somebody else. And you can't just sit there in front of your computer and resent it. You either got to give up the sale or put some more money in. And you know what? That's the same way with any other commitment in our lives. When it's not working out the way you wanted it to do, you can't just get out of it, especially your marriage. and or anything else God has called you to do, you have to up your commitment to it. You have to up your sacrifice for it and put more money on the bid. You can't just float and get out of it, because God said you can't. So what does it require? You can't just sit there. Some people, I guess, would just sit there and stew at that computer screen day after day after day, fussing at the fact that their $10 didn't buy it. Well, if they really want that, it's going to cost them something. Love costs something. In fact, it costs everything. We saw that in the testimony of this man. Every day there were new demands on him. How do you keep from being bitter? You give more of yourself. You deny more of yourself. You sacrifice more of yourself. But you don't cut and run. And as he mentioned, this is a particular problem for us as husbands. That is why Colossians 3:19 says, "Husbands, love or choose to stay sacrificially committed to your wives, and be not bitter against them." A bitter husband, a resentful husband who is saying, "My wife never, she promised this, she's not coming through on this," that's a bitter husband, and he has given up love. He stopped sacrificing for the welfare of somebody else and has started focusing on himself. And Paul says, watch out, men. This is a particular problem for you. There isn't a week goes by that I don't hear another story of an abusive, self-centered, bitter husband who leaves a trail of hurting and bitter people in his family in his wake. I want to read you one of those. Just read this. I talked to this woman about a week ago. She had written an 18-page handwritten letter. I'm just going to read you a few paragraphs from it. And I called her and talked with her. She said, "When I was a student at BJU, I never thought I was going to be divorced one day. I committed myself to John." That's not his real name. "I loved him. It's strange to admit, but John rarely said he loved me, the words, anyway, before marriage. He never freely said them even after marriage. I used to think he loved me, but just didn't like saying the words. Men, wives are notorious for reading the best into their husbands' failures so they have somebody to respect. I was blind to many things throughout the marriage. After graduation, he became a teacher in a Christian school. I became pregnant with our first son. I was very sick and bedridden. The doctors could not find out the problem. It wasn't until my second pregnancy, when we had switched doctors, that I learned I could have died in my first pregnancy. I was on IVs in the second pregnancy and medication and confined to bed. My doctor told me it was the worst case he had seen in all the years of his practice. During my first pregnancy, John was angry that I was so sick. He told me I embarrassed him. He said I was worthless, that I couldn't deal with just morning sickness like all the other pregnant ladies in our church. During my pregnancy problems, John stayed long hours at school attending every sporting event instead of helping me at home, even though he wasn't required to attend. He never called to check up on me and see if I needed help. He didn't want my parents calling me either. I found out later he had turned off the phone ringer, so I never heard it all the times my parents called to see how I was doing. He would not allow me to call my parents. I rationalized that he was being frugal with our meager finances, and I was cut off from anyone's help or care. I was young and I didn't know. I believed I was worthless and just couldn't cope with morning sickness. My mom wanted to come for the delivery. We called her in plenty of time to drive to the hospital in our town, but John purposefully gave her wrong directions, so she ended up in the next town. He later confessed to this. Before my pregnancy, I noticed John's interest in one of the girls in the school. She obviously had a crush on him, too. I talked with John about it, but he dismissed my concerns. When I recovered from the pregnancy, I was shocked to see how she flirted with him at a game I attended. I confronted John about it. The girl actually called the house while my mother was staying with me one day and asked if John was there. Later, I found a letter from her to John. Its contents were totally inappropriate. The truth came to the attention of the school officials, and John was fired. We moved to our present city so I could be near my folks, since John couldn't find a job. John was always angry with me and the two children. He got a job working at a local retailer. I was always hoping things would be better. I would say, it'll be better if he gets a full-time teaching job. And then if he got a manager position, it would get better. And later, if he got off the harder third shift, it might be better. As a salaried manager, he told me he was required to work long hours, and I believed him. I would learn later that he wasn't at work one entire day a week. Managers worked 4 10-hour days. He was gone 5 days a week. I dismissed his anger as being tired from his long hours. In his anger, he would strike out at me with his fist and stop just inches short of my face. I was scared. He would grab my arm violently. He threatened me. He yelled at me and the boys. We couldn't laugh when he was at home. I was happy with my children when he was at work. I would take the children to the bedroom where we would sit quietly when he was angry. I was not allowed to purchase the groceries myself. I would make a grocery list beforehand. He would always snatch it from me, read down through every item, and tell me how worthless I was. He'd say, "There's nothing on here I like." I always asked him to please tell me something he would like for me to put it on the list, but he would never tell me. He would just stay and said, "You don't know anything about me." And I'd ask him again, and he would respond, "You're so worthless, you can't even make a grocery list by yourself." At the grocery store, we had to go up and down the aisles for hours. He yelled at me about everything on the list I'd made, humiliating us. He yelled at the boys in public, also in church, scaring the other children. He called me every day from work, sometimes several days, ordering me what and when to feed the children. I have healthy children who rarely have to visit the doctor. I followed all the books. I was a school teacher myself. I knew how to study. My parents weren't allowed to visit when John was home. My sister had to hurry and leave if all of a sudden John arrived at home at an unusual time. My neighbors testified in affidavits of these ways my family was treated by John. John had gotten us into financial troubles. I discovered bill collectors came. I would learn that John made a good salary with up to $8,000 yearly bonuses that I didn't know about. I found receipts for money he spent on women's clothing and flowers, not for me. And so many were daily restaurant receipts. A relative who started working at the department store where he worked said that the majority of workers didn't even know John was married or had a family. They told her of his affairs at work. When I confronted them about these things, he threatened to kill me, holding a broken glass up to my face. He choked our 10-year-old son, and I got a restraining order against him because his violence was escalating. God has given me such comfort, grace, strength, and courage to face what has been happening to me and the boys, and to face the unknown future. God has been with us through all of this and will be with us through the future. John would never allow me to renew my teaching license during our marriage. I just completed it recently so I can resume teaching. What I just read to you were the first 5 pages of the 18 pages, and the rest of the 13 pages were all the wonderful things God was teaching her and what she was finding out about what God was like. What a contrast this testimony is to Dr. McQuilkin's testimony. The difference is the commitment. One man is committed to his God and to his wife, and the other man is committed to himself. And I want just to spend a few minutes here talking about the characteristics of an other-centered man. And man, I hope we'll take some inventory to see if we're the kind of men that have the commitment that is needed for God to be honored in our families and our families to be blessed. An other-centered man, somebody who lives for God and other people instead of himself. Number one, he readily accepts and even invites input from his wife and others because he is humble enough to know he can't possibly have all the right answers all the time. An other-centered man, a humbled man, a man who has seen God as you heard about it in Ezekiel 1 this morning, a man who is humbled by God readily accepts input from his wife and from other people. Gentlemen, we can't possibly have all the answers right all the time. This kind of man knows that although he has the final say about things, he rarely ever exercises it. But usually amends his instinctive response because of information he receives from his wife and others. I think I've used the illustration with you before that the teamwork of a husband and a wife in a situation is exactly what goes on with the fact that we have two eyeballs. Most of us have two eyeballs. They're set anywhere between 6 and 24 inches apart here on our face. And what that does is allow us to see the same thing from a little different angle. And then our brain processes the difference in what it sees, and they talk together up there in our brain and work out what is going on. And it is because of that, because of seeing things from two different angles, that we have judgment, we have depth perception. And a man who will not listen to the input of his wife, the other eyeball, it's like a man who's driving with only one eye. He has no depth perception. He has no judgment. And he ends up making a lot of stupid things. I can't tell you how many times my wife and I have heard of situations exactly like this situation. And there are two characteristics that happen with this guy. He has serious financial problems. Why? Because his wife is not involved in that. And a wife gives wonderful judgment about things. Now, you may have to make the final decision about something, but boy, our wives need to come into that, because our wives have a whole lot of thinking about some things we're not thinking about. I can't tell you when the last time was that I made a decision against Patty's counsel. It has been decades, I think. Because I need the judgment of that woman in my life. I am not complete without her, and God said that Himself. And He made her a helper fit for me. And I need her judgment. I can't tell you when we say, well, who makes the decisions in your family? We do. And it's supposed to be that way. There are two perspectives here that need to be brought into that thing. Rarely should it ever be that a man, and there's some men, a self-centered man may listen to his wife so that he can proudly say, I listened to her, and then he always does what he wanted to do in the first place. That's an arrogant man. That's a man destroying his family because he's thinking that he's the only one who has any good judgment. And he's cutting off half of his eyesight. And he doesn't even realize how foolish he is. A humble man seeks input from his wife and from anybody else who can give it, because he knows he possibly can't get it right all the time himself. Secondly, an other-centered man willingly makes himself accountable to other men, especially the spiritual leaders in his life, and doesn't mind being asked hard questions about how he is doing. A self-centered man isn't like that. If you start pressing him about what's going on, he'll move on. You begin to work with him in the church about something that's going on in his life, and he'll find another church. That's a self-centered man. His ego cannot bear being tampered with. But an other-centered man understands again, he doesn't have all the answers. He can't possibly have all the answers. And it's easy for him to make wrong decisions, and he doesn't mind somebody else coming and saying, why did you do that? What have you been doing? How is it between you and God? How is it between you and your wife? Especially if those are men who are in spiritual leadership over him, his deacon or his pastor. In fact, a self-centered man listening to this sermon will try to dismiss the whole sermon because there's not so much scripture in it as an expository message. He has to find some way to deflect the responsibility. In fact, he'll take this home and shoot holes full of it through it to get himself off the hook. He will not humbly examine himself. Number three, an other-centered man takes seriously his wife's desire for increased unity. When she comes and says, honey, things aren't the way they used to be. We need to talk. He takes seriously his wife's desire for increased unity. He does not dismiss, patronize, or ridicule her feelings. He sees her needs as opportunities to build her up. Gentlemen, we men are relationally ignorant. We're just ignoramuses when it comes to relationships. In fact, to most men, the biblical mandate to leave father and mother and cleave to his wife is all about sex, and that's a very little part of that command. It's about leaving father and mother and cleaving to your wife to become one person. Like-mindedness is what that's teaching. When a wife comes and says, honey, something isn't right, a humble man immediately listens and then spends much time in personal inventory with God. I can remember some nights early on in our marriage and some nights not so early on in our marriage where we'd get discussing something as we went to bed, and my wife would bring up something and say, this is... And I wouldn't have an answer. And I'd say sometimes, honey, I'll come to bed sometime, but I've got to go find some answers. Gentlemen, if our wife comes to us and says, this isn't the way it used to be, you don't just dismiss that. If you have a commitment, then you sacrifice more of yourself. A humble man asks himself the questions that increase his own vulnerability and expose his nature. He has to ask himself questions like, what is so wrong with my life that my wife and children do not want to follow my leadership? Why am I so afraid of closeness to my wife and children? Why do I so zealously protect myself from probing questions my wife and children ask? Why do I live in such isolation relationally from them? Why do I pursue other things so passionately while neglecting my wife and children? A man has to ask himself those questions and be honest with himself. Someone has said most men think that a smoothly running home is the same as a smoothly running relationship. And it ain't so. I remember when we were first married and we'd have some thing we were trying to work out about finances. It was usually about finances because then we were so poor we couldn't pay attention. I mean, it was terrible. And she wanted to do something and I wanted to do something else. Or I'd do something and I wouldn't ask her. And she had planned on buying food with that. You know, I wasn't thinking about food. And when we'd all get it, I'd say, all right, honey, you know what? I realized I didn't check this and I didn't check that. And I've got it. I got it all set up. Okay, this next time I'll do this and this and this. Okay, are we all right? And you know what her answer would be? No. Because see, from her perspective, from my perspective, the problem was fixed when this problem was fixed. But from her perspective, it wasn't fixed till she was restored back in my sight to the position of the princess that she was in that family. It's not just solved when you say, all right, we got a procedure, we're going to fix it. From now on, all right, everybody follow the procedure, we'll be okay. All right, everybody got that? That does not fix the problem. It does for a man. It doesn't for his children and his wife. Sometimes when I was disciplining the children and I didn't handle it well, Patty would come back to me. I'd be out in the study and she'd say, honey, I know what you're trying to do and the girls needed to be disciplined, but I don't think it came across the way you wanted it to come across. I think right now they think you don't like them. And she was right. I thought it was fixed. I mean, I had measured out the punishment or whatever. We'd got it under, everybody knew where their place was right now. All right. Everybody got it? No, it wasn't fixed. It wasn't fixed until those three little girls knew their daddy loved them. Then it was fixed. And it's not fixed with Patty until she knows I love her dearly. Then it's fixed. And another centered man takes seriously his wife's desire for that increased unity. Most women who get a divorce don't want a divorce. They just want to stop the hurting. And when you do mess up, don't just bring her flowers and try to be good. Biblical reconciliation means coming and saying, I was wrong, will you forgive me? I cannot tell you how many young people have told me I've never heard my dad say he was wrong. That is a tragedy. It ought to be a regular occurrence in our families because we are regularly wrong. Ask her forgiveness. Tell her she's your princess again. Say, well, you know, we don't talk that way any longer. You did it one time. And since you're the leader, it's your fault if it's not happening now. And other-centered man understands his wife because she feels safe enough around him to share her thoughts and feelings with him. And sometimes we might say, well, you hear the world say this. You can't understand a woman. God says, oh, yes, you can. You can understand at least the one you're married to. In fact, you must. 1 Peter 3:7. He says, men, dwell with your wives according to knowledge or in an understanding way. And you know, the only way you can understand your wife is if you get a lot of input from her. And you won't get input from her unless you're safe to be around. If she starts telling you something and you just blow it off and say, oh, that stupid, emotional woman, you'll never get input from her and you'll never understand her. You can't understand as a teacher, you can't understand as an administrator, we can't understand students unless we listen to students. We can't understand our people in a congregation unless we listen to our congregation. We can't understand our wives and our teenagers unless we listen to our wives and our teenagers. Gentlemen, we have to be safe. Our children and our wives have to know they can come to us anytime and say, can I tell you something? Daddy, can I ask a question why you did that? Don't cross me. No. If you want to know how to understand your children, listen to their questions. Now, I'm not talking about rebellion or where they want to just argue. But we can gain a lot if we listen. Another centered man does not manipulate and control his wife, but rather leads her by example and gentleness. I think the thing that disturbs me most is the controlling, manipulative ways. And I'm not talking to the majority of the men here at all. In fact, I'm talking about all those guys out there. Okay, some of this. But woe be to the man who thinks of his wife as just another one of the kids. Another one he's got to tell what to do because she's so ignorant. You saw this in the letter I read. A controlling man handles relationships like he handles vending machines. If they don't give you what you want, you kick the machine. The more a man micromanages his wife, like we saw in that testimony I read, her contacts with family and friends, her postal and electronic mail, her interests and hobbies, her driving, her housekeeping, her parenting, her cooking, her shopping, and limits her efforts to engage him in conversation, the more he reveals his own inherent weakness as a man. He's using physical, financial, and positional power to maneuver, manipulate, demand, ridicule, withhold, withdraw, and control. He must demand and force compliance because he has no compelling humility that attracts willing followership from his wife. Gentlemen, we don't have to lead that way. And if you know men like that, that means we men need to be involved in their lives helping them. One other characteristic that came out in that testimony of John that we've seen over and over again, men like this reign as absolute sovereigns in their homes. And while they're calling everybody to do everything exactly right, they give themselves enormous freedom to do whatever they want. And I find these men absorbing themselves in their own private lives. Instead of engaging their family in ways that are helpful, they withdraw to their own private life, whether that is their work or their internet surfing or their computer games or their gambling or their sports or their hobbies or their pornography or their chat rooms or their instant messages. And most of these men become very absorbed with sex. They live in a fantasy world where they seem to be king. But Paul says, husbands, love your wives. Be committed sacrificially to sacrificing yourself for their welfare and be not bitter against them. Resentment is that first step in an affair. The second one is restlessness. She's not coming through. The kids aren't coming through for us. Mom and dad aren't coming through for us. My employer isn't coming through for us. And we're really resentful of that. And now we're restless because we want something that will give us a little bit of fun. And there's more conflict in the relationship, there's more distance, there's more dissatisfaction, and now we're looking for some kind of adventure. And looking out there for something fun, restlessness. And then there's rationalization. We begin now having to give excuses for why it's okay for us to go after that thing out there and leave our family behind and our responsibilities behind. And we're making excuses for not being at home. We're justifying a lot of mental activity here, justifying why it's okay for us to be doing what we're doing, laying plans for more involvement with that thing out there that we're having an affair, that person or that activity we're having an affair with, laying plans for more involvement. And now we're having more contact with the phone and on the internet or at work or whatever, but we're more engaged in what's out there than we are what's in front of us here. And our thoughts are preoccupied with that person or that activity. And all of that rationalization finally leads to the rendezvous. Now we are meeting together. We are living with that activity or with that person. Our family doesn't see us often because we're off chasing after the other person or chasing after the other activity. This is the anatomy of an affair. It's the anatomy of an affair, whether it's a teenager who is leaving home. He has a lot of resentment because of what is going on, and the expectations haven't come through, and he's restless, and he's looking for some adventure, and he rationalizes why it's okay for him to do it, and finally he rendezvous and takes off and meets out there with whatever it is he's chasing. It's true for husbands who are bitter at their wives. It's true of wives who are fed up with their husband's insensitivity and his distance and his abuse. It's true of church members who are bitter at something at church. It's true of students who are resentful of something at school. We go through this same process. Well, what do we do about it? Luke 9:23-24 says, "This." And folks, what we're talking about here is just the Christian life. Jesus said, "By this shall all men know that you're my disciples, by your love, your commitment to others instead of yourself, your willingness to sacrifice yourself for the benefit of other people." And Jesus calls us back to basic Christianity. Luke 9, 23 and 24, it says, if any man will come after me, let him deny himself. Take up his cross daily and follow me. For whosoever will save his life shall lose it, but whosoever will lose his life for my sake, the same shall save it. This is basic Christianity. And I've addressed some things, but I want many, many of you men can look over there and say, by God's grace, I got most of that. God's been teaching me that through the years. But all of us can use a little bit of fine tuning. I tell you what, going through this myself in the last several months, getting ready for the retreats, has been some fine tuning in my own life. And we can all use that. And this isn't just for us men. This is for all of us. All of us have people God calls us to love. All of us have commitments God has called us to fulfill. It will cost us something personally to do that. We need a whole army of humble, godly men who will live with their wives in an understanding way and not be bitter against them. And I encourage you men to sign up for that men's retreat. These are the times of fine-tuning. God did the most work in my life, in our marriage, at men's retreats at the Wilds. And God hammered me over and over and over and over again. And I needed it every year. And I hope you sign up for that. And I hope as well, if you're struggling with any of these things, that you make yourself accountable to your deacon or to your pastor and say, I need some help. Or to another godly man. But this is for all of us. This isn't just for men. All of us need to look at this and say, where do I need to deny myself for the commitments God has called me to have? Let's bow for prayer. Lord Jesus, these are hard things for all of us because there's so much of ourself in all of us. Father, I have needed this as you have hammered me in the last couple of weeks. And I pray by your grace you would continue that. And I pray for our men here, that you would continue to work in their lives. I thank you for raising up men in this church who love you and who love their families and who love other men who are struggling. And I pray that you would work in each of our lives. I pray that you'd work in the lives of our teenagers and the lives of our students and the lives of our women. That, Lord Jesus, we might be people committed to what you have called us to do. In your name.